Welcome, everyone, to the College Sports Briefing, your in-depth look at the business, legal, and social issues impacting college athletics today. I'm Daniel Hare, and on today's podcast, we're going to talk about the NCAA's rules regarding communicating with prospects during recruiting, and in particular, the use of social media. We had a story come out this past week about the use of Snapchat, which sort of spawned this topic. We'll also discuss the news this past week from two major ongoing legal battles. The O'Bannon case had its summary judgment hearing, and the Northwestern Player Union went before the Regional National Labor Relations Board. So we're going to get into both of those issues. Today is Sunday, February 23rd, and I'm so glad you're here and look forward to a great show. So first, let's jump right into the issue of social media and recruiting and the NCAA rules regarding that. There was an NCAA educational column that we'll link to and put on the show page where it goes through the various scenarios and for the first time mentions Snapchat among its list of communications tools. Now, before we get any deeper, the way the NCAA communicates its rules, and I mentioned an ed column, the first thing is there are actual bylaws, which is kind of the quote-unquote rule book. Then the staff will also issue interpretations of those rules. So if there's some gray area, you'll sometimes hear or see of staff interpretations of those rules. And then an NCAA ed column sort of takes those interpretations and puts them into context, maybe provides some examples. And that's where we've seen this come up with the issue of Snapchat among the recruiting tools that can be used potentially by coaches. So what's the general rule for coaches in communicating electronically with prospects? Well, if you just look at the rule itself, it talks about electronically transmitted correspondence that may be sent to a prospect, and I'm paraphrasing in some ways, is limited to email and faxes. That sounds like 1998. And all other forms of electronically transmitted correspondence, instant messenger, text messaging, etc., are prohibited. And so when we get down to what that actually means, we have to look deeper because, as a lot of laws do, and these are no different, there are exceptions to that general rule. And the exception allows that in basketball and hockey, funny enough, that if sent directly to the prospect, such as a direct message in Twitter or a Facebook message, but basically not in a chat room, not on a wall, not a reply tweet, so nothing that could be seen by others. That type of transmission is allowed. And sports, all sports besides football and track and field, will have the same freedom when August rolls around. There were some rules passed to sort of loosen up the restrictions on this communication. And so sports can kind of pass these rules on their own a lot of times. And that's why I mentioned basketball and hockey were sort of the first to do that. Now, all the other sports besides football and track and field have followed suit beginning this coming August. And the only other exception I would mention is that once a prospect has signed a national letter of intent and a few other kind of like documents, those rules go away. So in other words, once signing day just recently came and went, and those student athletes that signed national letters of intent with their schools can now, you know, if the football, basketball doesn't matter, they can communicate via these electronic messages with no problem at all. Now, the ed column, the educational column that came out, says that examples of prohibited electronic correspondence include, but are not limited to, text messages, instant messages, Snapchat, and comments on a PSA's prospective student athlete's wall or page, so like a Facebook page or their wall. And then it goes further in basketball and hockey, men's ice hockey, any type of electronically transmitted correspondence, such as email, fax, instant message, text message, and Snapchat, may be sent to the prospect And again, where those sports have kind of gone their own way. And that's one of the issues with, you know, just these rules in general, is trying to always keep up with the innovation of the tech companies and the way that they're expanding the opportunity to communicate between coaches and prospects is really impossible. And to ask the NCAA to do that, you know, I'm not a vocal proponent of a lot of what the NCAA does, but I have tremendous amount of sympathy in this case, because, you know, they're sort of asked to monitor and update the rules regarding recruiting and communication, and it's really not possible. I mean, you think about how quickly and nimbly these tech companies, especially these big ones such as Facebook and Google and Twitter, can move and add features and change the way communications are happening. And there's just simply no way a bureaucratic organization like the NCAA can possibly keep up with that. So we move on. So what is relatively new in basketball, and then coming this August to almost every other sport, is the inclusion of text messages and instant messaging as permissible forms of communication. So for a long time, these weren't allowed. And on text messaging, the big issue was, you know, when text messaging first came out, there was a lot of cost involved with that. Particularly if you didn't have which most people at the beginning didn't have all, you know, unlimited data plans or unlimited text messages, or you know, 1,000 or 2,000 text messages a month or whatever, you know, students and prospects have now. But back then, you know, you were charged for every one, and those really added up. If you were a prized recruit and you were getting texted all the time by all these different coaches, whether you wanted to be recruited by them or not, you're personal cell phone bill or your parents' cell phone bill could really go through the roof. And so the text messaging was sort of immediately addressed once it kind of became popular, that it was a no-no and couldn't be done. And now that we've sort of moved past that issue to where it's fairly low cost, fairly common for, you know, high school kids or even younger to have cell phones with unlimited plans or very cheap plans for text messages, that's not really an issue. And so, you know, that's moving forward. And so what I see here is the NCAA is trying, albeit slowly, because, you know, it's the NCAA, but to get to a place where they aren't updating their rules for every new communication service that comes along. And so that's why I think they throw in to Ed Collins things like Snapchat, or back in 2009-10, Twitter, because, you know, as sort of four examples, or, you know, in other words, because in parentheticals to rules, because they don't want to have to go in and specifically pass new bylaws or new legislation to address each new communication platform that becomes popular. And so you see these pop up in Ed Collins. And so, you know, come August, they may actually be close to achieving that goal in most sports. And, you know, one thing specifically to Snapchat, you know, big question sort of on that is, you know, will it be heavily used as a recruiting tool, you know, or should coaches, if they have the flexibility to use that, to do so? And simply depends. You know, I think that good recruiters are going to go wherever the recruits are, and they're going to use every tool available to them to communicate with those recruits. So if Snapchat is the best tool to reach recruits, or even a specific recruit, good coaches that are good recruiters are going to absolutely use it to the, you know, extent allowed by the rules. And, you know, if coolness factor wears off and recruits move off Snapchat and onto some other service, you know, then that's where you're going to see coaches go next. I do seriously question the need for any regulation at all. You know, the communication methods across the board right now are so low cost. You know, the settings you can set in terms of privacy, in terms of, you know, ignoring calls, ignoring emails, filtering messages that you don't want to hear from people are so advanced that, you know, I think we're at a place where we can sort of remove most, if not all, of the communication restriction upon, you know, upon coaches. And any limitation really seems to be putting up unnecessary roadblocks to coaches getting to know prospects and prospects getting to know coaches better, which, you know, I think is ultimately a better thing. It's a better reward if we're able to allow those relationships to grow and, you know, for them to get to know each other as best they can before the prospect has to make a recruiting decision. You know, and they're so limited right now in how much that can actually happen that the more we can reduce those barriers, I think the better. You know, competitive balance is an issue that we often try, or that the NCAA often tries to limit the advantage for, you know, larger budget schools in rules and in things like this, just with the resources that, you know, schools with big staffs have to you know, be on all these platforms all the time and find these recruits or communicate all the time. And I think that, it would be better served, a better way to go would be to limit the regulations in terms of the numbers of staff members that are allowed to contact recruits, which there are those in place, but I think to focus more in that realm and not so much on the type of communication and the frequency of the communication, because we just simply, I don't think as a, you know, don't, the NCAA is not in a place to be able to respond and to update all of the time with the new communication methods. And I think it ultimately cuts against allowing prospects and coaches to develop relationships that are helpful to making decisions on where the prospect will be best served going to college. So, that's where this issue is. And it'll be interesting to see as we move into August and where football goes with this as well. But thought it was worth mentioning here. Let's go ahead and transition over to the O'Bannon case. And I talk about that a lot. I write about that a lot. It's sort of obviously the biggest thing probably going on in college sports legal issue right now. And so Thursday, the plaintiffs and the defendants had a hearing before Judge Claudia Wilken to argue their summary judgment motions. And just for, quick definition of that, so we kind of create some context. Summary judgment is basically sort of the legal jargon for asking the court to rule in favor of one party or the other party after gathering evidence, but before a trial. So this basically each side submitted a motion for summary judgment, asking the judge to basically end the case in their favor after now they've collected a bunch of evidence, taken a lot of depositions, you had a lot of documents released to each other, and have asked the judge that, basically saying, you don't need to take this to trial. There's not any, all the facts are either on our side or not in dispute, and you should make a ruling in favor of us today and not allow this to go to trial. And basically, where it looks like she came down, she'll issue a formal ruling probably in the next few weeks, but her statements in the hearing on Thursday basically said that this will not end at summary judgment, that this will continue on either to trial or to a settlement if that were to come first. So what did we learn at this hearing? Well, the judge spent most of her time going after the NCAA and several of its justifications for limiting student athlete compensation at a scholarship. And I'll give credit here to a couple of folks. USA Today's Steve Berkowitz was there and was live tweeting, as was SI's Stuart Mandel. And so you can go read, and I'll link out to both of their stories on this hearing, because they did a great job of both writing the stories, but also live tweeting. And I would encourage you to go into their Twitter feeds to last Thursday and follow their tweets coming out of that. Really, I think, insightful stuff to hear kind of the judge real time and to see how they both heard different things that jumped out to them that were important and how they quoted her. So I thought that was interesting as well. So the judge didn't seem to concede at all that the current model is presumptively legal, as the NCAA likes to suggest and likes to argue. Obviously it's been, decades of law that, the amateurism model is a legal one that can be upheld. But in this situation, the judge isn't looking for that. The judge is looking for the NCAA to show more than that, to be able to show why and not just presume that it's true. And so I thought that was something that was really interesting. She also took issue with the NCAA's argument that broadcasting college sports was protected First Amendment speech and in sort of the strong public interest. In other words, something that the public desperately needs to know about, sort of like a news story. And, there were two tweets that came out of that, and I mentioned both Mr. Berkowitz, Mr. Mandel on this, and but they're quoting Judge Wilken, and her quotes were, "I don't think I'm really buying commercial speech, quote unquote, First Amendment speech. And if the public is so interested, why can only CBS show certain games?" And it's funny because I had tweeted something similar earlier in the morning, kind of preparing for this hearing and reading about it and some of the arguments the NCAA was making. And that's one of the things I think is really interesting. I'll get into my opinions on all this later. But you know, it looks like the NCAA is sort of trying to have it both ways with this First Amendment argument. You know, they use it to kind of withhold payment from their players because they say it's a First Amendment protected speech issue. But then at the same time, they go out and sell their rights to these games for millions and millions and millions of dollars. And so, you know, as opposed to just letting any news network that wants to come in and cover it like a news event. And so I think that's going to be an interesting argument to watch down the road. You know, she questioned the judge, Judge Wilkin questioned the NCAA's competitive balance argument as well. You know, the NCAA, one of their big things on this is they don't want to tip the scales of competitive balance by allowing obviously the bigger and larger schools to pay their players. And you know, her quote in response to that was, you know, isn't there a less restrictive alternative than essentially capping compensation for student athletes at a scholarship? You know, and her, she went further. Maybe you could enforce more competitive balance by addressing coaching salaries or the money spent on stadiums. I thought that was really a pointed question and a good point that she brings up there. And then finally, she took issue with the argument that restraint on compensation promotes integration of athletes within the school's academic environment. And I think, in other words, saying the NCAA, they're saying, you know, a scholarship is sort of what we do with, you know, music majors and drama majors and, you know, or you know, folks that have, you know, talents other than athletics, and we give them scholarships. We don't pay them, you know, to come in and go to school, you know, anything above that. And so I think that's kind of their argument there. And she took issue with that as well. The O'Bannon lawyers didn't face quite the level of scrutiny that the NCAA did, but they did, you know, see on one particular issue, which was that it appeared that it sort of surprised Judge Wilkin, or maybe it was something that there was some confusion on, that they were, the plaintiffs were looking to allow compensation to be collected by athletes moving forward while they were still athletes. And it seems that she had had the impression that whatever the final kind of judgment or ruling was from this case was that any compensation that they might get, whether it be from, you know, sponsorship or anything else, would be set aside in some type of fund for when the student athletes are no longer students or when they graduate. And I think that stems from, we've seen that they've already set up sort of an organization to do that duty, to collect, you know, monies, sponsorship monies, others to hold while students sort of in trust, while student athletes finish their careers. And I think that's where she's getting that from. And so it is going to be interesting to see how that plays out. Although the plaintiff's lawyer, the O'Bannon lawyer, did say they were open to that type of arrangement. Although it looks like they were trying to sort of shoot for the moon here and go ahead and open it up to where they could collect while they're in school. So it'll be interesting to see if they stay, the plaintiffs, if this moves forward to trial, if they try to make that case that they could get paid while they're in school, or whether they go ahead and just leave that issue off the table and make it all about that they, you know, if they were to be paid something or allowed to be compensated for anything else, that it would be held for them until after school is over. So my thoughts on this this hearing and this issue, I think the judge seemed to be asking the right questions and probing the right areas in terms of where the NCAA's case seems weak. I kind of went into my issue with their First Amendment argument earlier. I think that it's a really tough road to go for them to try to make the case of the First Amendment issue, that it's essentially a news event that is of a great public concern, of great public interest, but yet they're going to hold the public hostage essentially by charging exorbitant rights fees to networks who then pass those on to the cable providers who pass that on to us, the public, the consumers. And so it's a vast public interest, yet we have to pay a huge fee because the way that they, you know, sell these exclusive rights. And so I think that's a tough case to make. It seems hypocritical. It seems like they're trying to, as I said earlier, have their cake and eat it too. They're using this First Amendment argument to prevent them from having to pay the athletes, but at the same time, you know, not having a problem at all with selling those rights for, you know, tens and tens of millions of dollars. You know, it makes me wonder, why doesn't CBS or ESPN, if they're going to call this First Amendment, you know, free speech, it's a news event, it's a public interest story, then why would the networks pay anything at all? Why wouldn't they just cover it like a fire down the street and just go walk right in, set up shop and film it and broadcast it, if that's what this is, if this is a First Amendment issue? And so I think that's the struggle, and that's the difficulty. My personal opinion is that it is something they can sell rights fees for the way that they currently do. But at the same time, that takes off the table the issue of this being a First Amendment issue. So we'll see where they go there. The competitive balance argument to me makes very little sense at all. You know, they've got without a top line budget cap. So, for example, saying that you can only spend $15 million or something on football per year, lifting the restriction on student athlete compensation just merely means that you're going to kind of change how you divvy up the expense pie. So if right now you're spending, you know, a third of it on coaches' salaries, a third of it on facilities, and a third of it on operations, well, now you just have to sort of adjust those fractions to now include a certain chunk that's going to go to the student athletes. It doesn't shrink or enlarge the actual pie itself. It's still $15 million, or it's still $20 million, or whatever it is that you spend. And that's still way greater than whatever the, you know, smaller schools spend, and theirs aren't changing either. And so I don't really understand the competitive balance argument at all. You know, it's just the big budget schools are still going to have big budgets. The low budget schools are still going to have low budgets. So not making a lot of sense there. So I do think a settlement is more likely now than it was before the hearing. However, I still think the odds of a settlement are not very good. And the reason is the NCAA has, on this particular issue, on kind of fundamental structure of amateurism and so forth, has not settled. They have fought these all the way through. They've been successful nearly every time. They've had to go all the way up to the Supreme Court several times, and they have the resources and the will and the patience to do that. And the stakes for them are really high. So I still don't see a settlement coming unless the plaintiffs are just willing to give up a lot of their fight and a lot of their arguments and for kind of a small victory, maybe. But I don't see some dramatic change in the model coming from a settlement with the NCAA. So that's where that is. And we'll get some type of ruling from Judge Wilkin in the next few weeks. But as I already mentioned, she said basically in her comments that there will not be a summary judgment motion granted here, that this is going to go on towards trial, if not a settlement beforehand. And then I'll just briefly mention the union hearings that happened is our third topic. Just real briefly, we covered this in depth both in the blog and then on the first podcast. So I won't go into too much detail, but we did have hearings at the Regional National Labor Relations Board in Chicago this past week, where there was testimony given in terms of the Northwestern players trying to establish a players' union. And some interesting things that came out of that, I thought, when Northwestern was on the stand, one of their administrators was giving testimony saying that when they travel, their hours are not counted in their countable athletically related activities, which are limited to 20 hours per week, and that therefore those hours were voluntary, kind of explaining why a lot of what they're doing is not work or why they're not employees, the student athletes. And I just thought that was almost an insane argument to make, that the travel was voluntary because it wasn't counted in their 20 hours they're allowed per week by the NCAA. That's a true statement, but that's an argument to use in this case just made absolutely no sense to me. There was another quote about that scholarships come with no strings attached. And that's another one that was just almost laughable. You know, I think the context of that was that, you know, every scholarship athlete, regardless of their ability, gets the same scholarship. And that's true in football at Division I. They're all full ride, you know, they call them counters. And so it's just one person, one scholarship. You don't divide it up. You don't give less or more based on ability. But there's no question that you can not renew a scholarship if a student athlete's not performing. And I think the Northwestern coach, Pat Fitzgerald, when he was on the stand, essentially conceded as much, that while he's saying he hasn't actually let a student athlete go or removed a student athlete from a scholarship based off of performance, he could if he wanted to. And I think that was an interesting point in the testimony. And also with Coach Fitzgerald, who apparently did a really good job, it sounded like, and handled himself well. And, you know, but he was there was a quote thrown in his face by the player's attorney about, you know, what quote that he had saying that football is basically a job. And, you know, a lot of coaches say that, you know, for student athletes, they have to be disciplined. They have to treat it like a job. They have to come every day to work, you know, and all of that. And you know, it's sort of, you know, just cliche almost, but, you know, in used in this context, when we're trying to define, is it a job? Are they employees? It has a different ring to it. And so that I thought that was interesting, but we're going to see how this goes ahead and, you know, where it goes from here. As we said, it can go from the regional board up to the national board, depending on which way it goes. I'm sure the other side will appeal. So we've got a ways to go here, but go back and read some of the testimony from the union hearings this past week. They were very interesting. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode. I encourage you to go to the blog collegesportsbriefs.com for show notes and links to the things we talked about here, as well as other articles on college sports law and business. You can check out the Facebook page, facebook.com/collegesportsbriefs. And you can follow me on Twitter at Daniel Hare. I appreciate you listening and hope you enjoyed this edition of the College Sports Briefing.